This is WCOM LP Chapel Hill and Carrboro 103.5 FM on your radio dial. And this is Claudio Speakeasy, the literary and all else. And coming up right now to the mic is the bard and Renaissance man of WCOM, Claudio.
Good morning. Good morning, everybody out there, whoever's tuning us in. And that was Audrey Layden you heard. She's actually from Carrboro Bookbeat. And she's agreed to be my co-host for as long as we can make that happen. We have the wonderful pleasure of having the Broadway babe, new director of Temple Theatre, although at this point I wouldn't say it's so new anymore. She's a homegirl now.
That's right.
Peggy Taphorn in here with us.
It's great to be back.
Great to have you back. And we're going to talk about all things Temple Theatre for a little bit, and then we're going to switch rails, but we'll surprise you with that a little later.
Mm-hmm.
I want to give a quick shout-out to the Carolina Theatre of Durham, see what's happening on their website. They are the primary sponsor of Claudio Speakeasy, the literary and all else. And once again, thank you for tuning us in. I'm going to go over to Peggy to talk about the Temple.
The Temple, I am very proud and honored to say, this year is in a lot better position than we were last year.
I know. Bravo to you.
Yay.
For that.
Yay! Yes. We're still here.
She's an able captain, folks.
Well, our belt's about as tight as it can get, so I'd like to take a breath every once in a while, but we just did a wonderful run of a world premiere production of A Christmas Carol that was a big hit for us.
Wonderful.
My friend Michael Hoagland, who I affectionately call Hoagie, wrote beautiful original music for it, and we had 38 actors, over 300 costumes, beautiful set work. I found a new scenic artist out of Greensboro, and it just really all came together. What's his or her name,
if one might know?
His name is Tim Billman.
Tim Billman, okay.
Mm-hmm. A wonderful artist, and a new lighting designer. Unfortunately, Blowing Rock was one of the fatalities last year. That theater closed, so I've been trying to incorporate some of those technical people and artists to try to give them a little cash in these days. I know.
Yes, we do.
Places closing down.
But that's why I'm so happy the Temple's still here, and I'm really excited. Coming up next, January 29th through February 7th, it's a limited run, only Fridays and Saturdays at 8 p.m. and Sundays at 2 p.m., we are having Mike Wiley come and do Blood Done Sign.
I want to be in that. I told you from the start, I want to see that one.
It's a 90-minute multimedia show. Mike's a wonderful
multimedia
actor. Yes, he does. He does projections and some video
montage.
Well,
I remember the one I was, I won't say a part of in the sense of having you folks on the show.
Right.
But something like Macbeth?
It's not interactive like that. It really is just a screen with different visual images. And then he has a gospel singer who comes in and out as a Greek chorus. And it's a 90-minute presentation. Then he does a talk back after every show. And Tim Tyson, who is the author, who has local ties to Sanford, his father was a pastor at two of the Sanford churches.
I remember you telling me about him, yes.
And some of the incidents in the book, Blood Done, Sign My Name, take place in Sanford. Tim is coming for both Sunday matinees to join Mike on the talk back.
Well, bear me in mind for one of those.
I will. And there's a racial equality group in Sanford called One by One. And after every Sunday matinee, after the talk back, during the talk back, they're also going to have a little reception so people can mix and mingle. So I'm really excited about that.
Fantastic, yeah.
And again, those dates are January 29th through February 7th because it really is selling quickly. So if you want to come and see Mike Wiley and meet Tim Tyson, those are the dates to
do it. Can I put in for a seat now then?
Yes,
with you.
Absolutely.
Okay.
I'll put you on the list.
Give them the phone number and website and all that jazz.
The phone number for our box office is 774-4155. That's area code 919. And our website is templeshows.com. And you can get tickets online as well.
Easy enough.
Yep.
I know that's going to be truly worth it. I've been intrigued by that one ever since you mentioned it many months ago on the radio show.
That's right. And then just very briefly, the rest of our season is we're bringing back Jason Petty, who played Hank Williams for us two seasons ago. He's got a new show about Marty Robbins, and he's, like you, is a wonderful storyteller as well as a wonderful musician.
Wonderful.
He's got a live 9-piece band on stage. He channels Marty Robbins and all those, all the big country singers of that era.
I love Marty Robbins.
Yeah.
The old westerns.
Talk about a balladeer. He really does. Then they're all sad. He doesn't get the girl. He gets shot. The horse dies. But it's beautiful music.
Time to go ahead and play that record backwards. It gets more positive.
Exactly. And then we wrap up the season. That's Marty's El Paso is March 11th through the 28th. And then our classic R&H musical we can announce now because it's gone from Raleigh is South Pacific.
Aha! All
where
right.
I humbly say I am.
Oh, we were
Nelly
dropping
Forbush.
Hints with the melody last time.
That's right. And that one is April 29th through May 16th.
Now, is it Nelly who sings I'm Gonna Wash That Man Right Out
yes.
of My Hair? Right,
mm-hmm.
right.
And Cockeyed Optimist. It really is you know, having done a couple of old crotchety characters the past couple of times, I'm actually going to do an Optimus this time. So that's just a beautiful story.
Uh-huh. Are you
going to
bring back the show that you did a solo performance? What was the...
The Betty Hutton Show, Square in the Social Circle.
You ever do
that
again?
We're still working on it. We're doing some rewrites.
How many songs is it you sang?
26.
By herself on stage.
Oh, my goodness.
God,
darn near killed me.
I don't think I've recited 26 poems in a row.
Let's talk about a firecracker. Betty Hutton certainly
just
had energy.
Just remembering it all.
Yes.
Right.
Just.
Well, we'd done it in New York several times, and we did it across the United States for a while, and we're still, you know, tweaking it. But these days, 99.9% of my focus has been on keeping the temple alive. So,
no doubt. And when did that actually begin coming around? Because I know the last few times you were on, we were really sort of letting the public know that
that's
the temple
right.
needs support.
Well, we did a huge plea last January, and the community really responded. It's very heartwarming. It's sort of like A Wonderful Life. We didn't have one big sponsor who came in with a $10,000 check, even a $1,000 check. It literally was people... I always get a little verklempt.
No,
coming by with $10, $20, $5.
That's what keeps this station afloat.
You better believe it. Mm-hmm. And I will be eternally grateful. And the good thing is that it actually got the community back involved and showed what a great asset the Temple Theater is. You know, I call it Statue of Liberty Syndrome, having lived in New York for 21 years.
Mm-hmm.
I would only go when I had relatives or friends. And and that's sort of, you know, what's happened to the Temple Theater. People are like, oh, I love the Temple. And I'll say, oh, what was the last show you saw?
Yeah,
well,
right.
I saw something in 89.
Ten years ago, yeah.
But now we really have reinvigorated the local community, as well as brought back some of our people because of the gas prices. Luckily, they have dropped quite a bit.
Yes, they could drop a whole lot more if we didn't have so much greed out there.
Mm-hmm. But our big challenge is we've lost quite a few groups, and so that's where we're still lacking in sales. So
groups,
if you ever get a group
sense?
Together.
What do you mean?
Well, we used to have, on our Thursday matinees, used to be sold out completely, 330 seats gone. And the past couple years, we've had about an average of 80.
And when you say groups, you just mean people gathering people together?
Or? Well, and people coming from retirement villages.
So
the
okay.
school matinees are still sold out.
Oh, good.
Which is great.
The senior center from here in Chapel Hill used to go out to the Temple Theater regularly. Are they still going?
I think we see some of them.
Okay.
But I know a lot of these, you know, group homes and situations have arisen, like they have for all of us, where they've had to cut back on their extracurricular activities. So,
and sadly, the arts always seems to take the first blow.
Yeah.
Right. But we'll get them back. We have a very exciting lineup for next year. I can say that you're hearing it here first.
Aha, so run us off.
I just announced it to the board last night at our Christmas holiday party. And it's all, you know, I have to be able to get the licensing for these shows, but in my mind, we want to kick off the season with Chicago.
Aha!
Aha.
You're going to be in it.
Oh, yeah.
I can see you showing some leg.
So we want to do Chicago, and then we haven't done a farce in a while, so either Flaming Idiots, which is very funny. It's about two chefs.
Ah, oh boy.
Who decide that they were postal workers.
Oh, no.
But they're tired
of that. They go psycho any
minute
now. So
they want to be entrepreneurs, so they're going to open this restaurant, and there's a restaurant across town that 20 years ago had a mob hit, and so people flocked to it because there was a death. So these guys, for their grand opening stage, a murder, and then, of course, everything goes wrong. So. Or let me attend.
I'm familiar with that, but that sounds great.
It's a new play, and it's very funny. Okay. And then we're going to bring back Christmas Carol because it was such a big hit for us this year.
Good.
Then the rest of the season, we're doing a co-production with Bernie Cole up in Raleigh of a wonderful, I call it a playsicle, called Crowns.
Crowns.
It's about the hats that African-American women wear to church and how that started and what that means.
And stories that sort of emerge.
Exactly.
From that,
exactly. It's a big cast. There's a lot of singing and a lot of moving anecdotes. And then,
well, speaking of Burning Coal, you know that David Henderson is going to direct Seafarers for the stage.
I did not know that. Oh, great.
Working with Ira David Wood wants it back at Theater in the Park, but I just want to put wheels on it. So
absolutely.
Henderson has agreed to be the director.
Excellent. Good
anyway,
for you.
Back to you.
A good man at the helm.
Yes.
The rest of the season looks like Little Shop of Horrors, and then we are going to end with Cats.
Cats,
wow.
You're going to be in that one too, aren't you?
Now and forever. Well, I have all these teens, and I'm really pleased with how the past
few years... Didn't
you do
that one before?
No.
Oh, okay, I don't know what I was thinking about.
And it hasn't been done in this area, and I think that I can produce it well, and I have the local talent, and there are a lot of dance troupes in the Sanford area, so we're going to actually start working on that pretty much this spring.
Tell our local listeners exactly how they find the Temple Theater.
The Temple Theater is very easy. It's on Carthage Street in downtown Sanford. Basically, if you take 15501 till it dead ends in Sanford, make a right, go across the railroad tracks, and you're right there.
Wow.
You can't get easier.
Pretty easy.
You know, 35 minutes from here?
It took me about 35 minutes.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And we get a lot of our audience from Chapel Hill, Carrboro, Pittsburgh, Siler City.
Yeah, there's a good support base here.
Mm-hmm. As well as Southern Pines, Fayetteville. We're getting more and more people from Greensboro because I've found that there's a wealth of talent in Greensboro.
Yeah.
Oh, you're talking about talent. How about people coming,
And people
too?
Coming.
Wonderful.
Because our ticket prices are so reasonable.
Uh-huh.
It's $10 for Lee County educators and anyone with a student ID.
Uh-huh.
Our maximum ticket price is $20 if you have a group of 10 or more, or if you buy season tickets, and our season tickets are flexible. You can buy six for $96 or four for $64 and use them in any combination for any show.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful.
And that ticket price comes down to $16. So it's affordable and it's good.
Do you still have the $5 night?
We still do for each performance.
Which is a wonderful idea. Just before the show goes on.
Uh-huh.
Like a dress rehearsal.
It's our final dress rehearsal. It's something, because I didn't grow up having access to a theater, and I think theater should be for everyone.
Uh-huh. Yes.
I instituted community night, and it actually is a pay-what-you-will night. We suggest a $5 donation, but if you don't have $5, you can just come on in. And it's usually our best crowd because people are so excited to be there.
That's fantastic.
And a mixture of non-theater going and people who are just checking it out for the first time. And it's usually the Wednesday prior to our opening on the Friday nights.
Mm-hmm. So keep that in mind. I know that's already a popular draw, but I definitely think there are people out there that can afford that.
That's right. And that's what's going on at the Temple. But I actually was interested, you know, this time of year, a lot of us get nostalgic and think about, you know, where we've been, where we're headed, you know, where we are presently. And I know that your listening audience is probably a little curious about the man behind the voice.
Oh, no.
So I wanted to talk a little about Claudio and how you came to this area and where you started. So, and I know you had a very interesting beginning.
To say the least.
Being the scandal of the family. So do you want to speak to that?
Well, I want to just jump in right now.
Thank you. Rescue. Wonderful.
I'm not going to rescue you. I'm just going to add to it. And that is to let everybody out there know that Claudio will be the featured artist at the Cotton Company in historic Wake Forest from February 7th, right after your show is ending.
Mm-hmm.
From February 7th through March 8th of this coming year, he'll be staging recitals of his own writings along with his artwork. And the Cotton Company is a place where artists can work and sell their wares as well.
Indeed.
So that's, and it's in beautiful, historic Wake Forest. It's a beautiful downtown.
It's a gorgeous building,
right.
too.
So remember that, February 7th through March 8th this coming year. You can hear Claudio, and now we can really put him.
Dig
this
in.
Is a roasting toast.
Because you really are a Renaissance man, which are rare these days.
I'm told.
Uh-huh. So I think it's interesting to see how you became a poet and an artist and a seafarer and, you know, wandered around the Caribbean for many, many years, and now you live in North Carolina. So
somehow it was sort of been my springing point since coming to the States, but
His beginnings are very interesting.
Exactly.
Born in Germany by an Italian mother and a German father whom I never actually met. I'm the product of a love affair. I know there was love in them while I was happening, but it very sort of quickly faded afterwards and turned into the two of them parting company. There was no marriage involved and nobody was married at the time. But nonetheless, back in the old Germany of the 50s, a child born out of wedlock was a big scandal, so I was the big sin in everybody's life that knew me at the time, I suppose. I was this little 3-year-old boy, and I think probably on some subconscious level, I took to the arts because that was a place where I could feel normal. I don't know, even I know that I was actively drawing comics since age 5, so who knows what I was thinking of or what was going on while I was still in that womb without a view, you know? But
exactly.
My mother was very artistic. I think she was a frustrated artist who never really was able, for practical reasons, to pursue. She had great singing talents and a wonderful speaking voice, but was never able to do anything with that because of her situation of having this little boy tagged along. So,
but obviously she made the right choice.
I think so. Mm-hmm. I was sort of... She married my stepfather back in the 50s, and we were living under his parents' roof. They had a big farmhouse in old Germany, a place called Niederstotzingen, The name Nidvorok, I think, derives from there somehow.
Uh-huh. So you grew up speaking German?
Old railroad town, yes.
And Italian?
No. Regretfully, I will always regret that. Italian was considered a second-class language, so I was not taught Italian. I was taught German, and I think that's just so much absolute rubbish to look at any language as being that. I have a very keen understanding of Italian intuitively, but I don't speak it well. So what I do is I listen for words they're using when they're addressing me, and I try to use them in some jumbled way to respond.
Right. Well, and back in the 50s, too, I know that, you know, I grew up with a German history as well, but mm-hmm. no one spoke German because they were living in America, so it was all about assimilation.
Deliberately didn't speak, which also sad.
That's right. My grandparents came from Germany, but I never heard them speak a word of German.
Goodness.
Mm-hmm. Well, bad words.
Right.
Every once in a while, by accident.
Well, I know we used to argue in three languages.
Exactly.
And oftentimes, whoever was guest at the time wouldn't understand two of them, so.
That's right.
We got away with some things.
So you started drawing at an early age.
I started drawing, and actually languages, believe it or not, were my first passion. At age 5 and 6, I was already speaking German and Afrikaans. I never took German in school, or, you know, I was never in German schools until I went back and did my apprenticeship as a chef many moons later in the mm-hmm. 70s. But it was just fun learning these communication skills. So I think I've always sort of been drawn to the communicative arts. And somehow my mother used to put these fairy tales in front of me, or read me Puss in Boots, or, you know, just Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, whatever, all these stories. I always asked for more stories. As a kid, the only thing I ever wanted for Christmas or for my birthday or for anything was another little record of somebody telling a story. And sadly, my mother gave those away during my trip to the Caribbean. I would have liked to have passed those on myself.
Right.
They were all in German.
Oh, that's neat.
But,
so how did you make the journey from Germany to Africa?
Well, being the scandal in my step-parents' or grandparents' home, and I think they were a very uncomfortable old Catholic family, the fact that I was, you know, born out of wedlock, even though the son was now married to the scandalous woman, my mother Matilda. I think there was just a lot of pressure put on, and my father's stepfather, who was a tool and die maker, pretty prominent, and he was offered a job in South Africa. It was the land for Germans and Italians to actually merge to and be seen as regular people, mm-hmm. normal people. So he went ahead of us, found a place, and I have to say that's one thing I'm most grateful for. Growing up in the Africa of that day was extraordinary. I was living on the pages of a history book. It was an incredible childhood. I probably outdid Huck Finn in the way I grew up.
Well, I know that you put your storytelling skills to work at boarding schools.
Yes, got into some trouble for that, too.
Were they tall tales, or were they...
No, they were stories I made up, because I was drawing comics, so the kids were really curious. I had this character named Don Psychro. And the name Psychro came from the idea of he was able to go into people's psyches. And the psyche became a geography on which he traveled with this person to help him sort of better identify their own life and maybe fix a few things that weren't right. But it wasn't done in a religious or preachy way. It was I basically turned psyches into a geography for adventure. Like it'd be you'd step outside and suddenly descend into this hole and come out in Borneo or some place.
I want to read them. I want to read
exactly.
them. Sounds great.
What was that show, Quantum Leap?
Quantum
the
Leap.
Show that was on TV where he kind of went back and would be part of a little episode
something. That was the closest to anything I've ever seen with Don Psychro. But the reason I created this character, and I have no idea where I had this perception so early on, because I didn't really like limits. I wanted to be able to take a story and not have it confined to being purely science fiction or purely fantasy. It was able to be all these things.
Mm-hmm.
So I created this character that was sort of non-defined. And a story could go in any direction. So what kids would do in boarding school in South Africa, and this was actually after hours, they were supposed to be in bed asleep. The prefects usually were, so they could sneak away and come to my section. And I would get a half a dozen of them or more that were part of the group. There were usually 50 or 60 or more that would sneak to my section. And they were very good about it. They kept very quiet, so nobody woke up, because there was a matron living not far down the hall, had a room. And I sometimes I was out of ideas. So I would have them come up with, a way to start the story. And two or three of them would bounce the story idea around between themselves. And as soon as I saw a nice hook for myself, I would grab it and run with it.
And go.
Yeah.
And back then, there wasn't, 300 channels on cable TV.
There was no television. I didn't know what television was until I came to America. Did I ever tell you that story?
No.
I'm going to jump ahead very quickly. We came here in 1969. Again, another tool and die position opened up in Winston-Salem this time. So from South Africa to Winston-Salem. and I came right into the 60s, which was totally fitting for me.
It's all being about a love child,
you know. Exactly. I finally got a chance to exercise the love child thing out of wedlock and all that jazz. Anyway, the flower power. But we came over, landed in New York City, and I remember them opening up the doors. Now, I'd felt heat in Africa. I mean, the sun in Africa was strong enough to bubble the tar in the streets.
Mm-hmm.
And I would literally go pick up those bubbles and mold little characters out of them. So there's always something useful to do if you had a mind for it.
Right.
And I remember coming over, and they opened the doors of the airplane, landing in New York City, which is where we immigrated. And I remember going, oh, my God. And I saw all these other planes lined up. And I looked at the stewardess, and I looked at all those other planes, and I said, man, those planes sure put off a lot of heat, don't they? And she goes, oh, boy, kid, you're in for a whole new experience, because I'd never felt humidity.
Humidity, right.
The heat in Africa is dry like the desert. And so this enveloping warmth was just something I was absolutely not familiar with. But it had been a 24-hour flight, so I was in another realm altogether anyway. I just wanted to get a bed, and we managed to get this. We flew from there to Winston-Salem and then got a motel in Winston-Salem. And I remember my brother decided to go and jump into the pool, another thing we'd never seen at the time, a place with usually in Africa motels were just motels. There was no additional luxury.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty conservative
just
place.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so my sister stayed with my mother and stepfather, and my brother and I got a room together, but he took off. I saw this little box in the corner on one of the shelves, obviously a television, but I didn't know what it was. I thought maybe some sort of radio, so I turned it on, but nothing came on. It was one of these boxes that I think took some time to warm up and then would come on.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm in the bathroom washing my face and just sort of cleaning up to go to bed. And all of a sudden, I hear these two people arguing with each other, just full volume, going at it. And I'm an old street fighter from the streets in South Africa. And I thought, God, somebody'd come into my room, and I had to defend myself again. So I come out with my fists clenched, and I looked, and it was Tony Curtis and Jack Lemmon going at each other in Some Like It Hot. And I was so amazed that a film could come through this bubble box here that I forgot all about sleep for a long time. And I just sat there and I watched this one movie to another, and then finally I must have just gone unconscious.
Just passed out.
Yeah. But now fast forward, some 30, 33 years later, I'm working Some Like It Hot at Memorial Auditorium. We just finished building the set on the stage. And you know how techies will play games with each other, right? And I get this tap on my shoulder, and I figure, okay, it's some wise techie getting ready to pull one on me. So I turn around with both my fists clenched, and it's Tony Curtis, who's just come to tell me that he loves the setting, and you know that we did a great job. So both of my experiences with Tony Curtis, I had my fists clenched.
That's some sort of past life connection.
There's something going on there. Yeah. But he was a great guy. He was totally for the crew, which was really cool. He bought us meals, and he hung out with us, which was pretty special. So hats off to Tony Curtis.
Well, anyway. he worked his way up as well.
Yes, he did. And he had a secondary part in that film, mm-hmm. I mean, in the Broadway version.
Right.
He played a secondary character. But it was interesting to see that he was still, you know, staying with that.
Right.
After all that time.
So when did you begin combining all of your talents, the storytelling as well as the artistry? And, of course, the wanderlust that seems to
have
happened from birth. Exactly.
The wanderlust was automatic. After seeing the one thing that I have to say that my stepfather did give us, every holiday we could work out, we'd go to a different place in Africa, in South Africa, even places that no longer exist now, like Rhodesia, Mozambique, and mm-hmm. so on, that have changed names because of the political situations. But I remember them as a kid. And I just remember, I guess there were times when I actually got to connect with the natives in these different places, and it instilled in me a desire to go and discover people on their own terms.
Mm-hmm.
You know, don't read about them or read about them, but then take that base knowledge and don't assume you know anything by it, and then just go to where they actually live, and if these people intrigue you at all, see what they're really like. And I became a drifter for, I'd say, at least 20 years or more of my life, and I'm still doing it now, but I have a few roots as far as having a stable home where I can put my things. I can still go.
Exactly.
And it's the reason I've also never married. I've always enjoyed traveling too much, and you can always find a romance on the way. So.
Absolutely.
But
especially the time in the Caribbean, I'm sure that was...
Oh, God, yeah.
Talk about heat.
Yes. In more ways than one, absolutely. That was one of my absolute favorite times, and I'm trying to think of which way to take this, but as far as combining the arts, I went from drawing comic books and creating dialogue and creating characters, And I think that helped me, the idea of actually writing the stories, because people, I would trade these comic books for like 6 or 7 real comic books, thinking I was getting a good deal. Now I wish I had them just to look at them.
Of course.
I have none, but I still draw. And people reading the comics would really like the storylines in them and said, have you ever written stories? And I thought, there they are, the drawings.
Right.
And I think the reason I went to drawing comics was because all these fairy tales I was given were always illustrated, even though they may not have been like comics.
Right.
But comics were my television. I had a stack of comics taller than me in my bedroom. And there were days you couldn't get me out of that room. I would just read one after another, after another, after another, and then go trade. And I was also a comic book thief back in those days.
Uh-oh, now we get down to the down and dirty.
Exactly.
I was, I'm afraid, very good at that in South Africa, where you went to jail for it and you got whipped. And they had, basically, the authorities had parental rights over you in Africa.
Well, I'm glad you were good at it then.
Yes, so am I. Not something I'm trying to boast about or be particularly prideful about, but that wasn't... They were a group of us that did this for each other, so anytime we were sick or we had a bad cold, couldn't make it to school, we'd nurture each other by whoever had comics that the other one hadn't read, bringing them to each other.
That's amazing.
Every one of them got caught sooner or later.
Ooh.
And they never told on me, so I'm really proud of those guys.
That's great.
I did stop after a while, but...
Well, good. You're not doing that today.
No.
I stopped. It was last week, but I have stopped.
Yes, exactly. I can afford a few more things now that I'm actually working for a living.
Exactly.
Back then I was a kid, so...
Right. It's hard to find comic books today anyway.
I know. It's such a pity, too. And
there is a store somewhere in Chapel Hill that sells the... It's the comic...
If I had kept my comic book collection, I'd be a millionaire.
Mm-hmm.
I never had any idea that would have been something that merited saving.
Right. But talk about saving. I have also traveled a lot in my life.
And, yes, I know.
And I go to people's homes and I see all these, you know, decades of memories, and I have none of that.
Yeah.
Because when you're traveling light most of the time, and being a freelance artist myself for most of my adult life. But it makes you live in the present.
It does. And
I've seen people get captured by these things, and they're so important, and this point in their life is so memorable. I was like, I don't have a picture of it, so I'm sure it was great. But now moving on.
Yeah.
Which I'm sure has happened for you. It forces you to live in the present and move forward, as opposed to kind of lingering
Absolutely.
In what can become the glory days.
But I did get a camera, and photography became another art form that I became very passionate about. But one of the reasons I was driven to photography was because I tell these people these extraordinary stories of travels, and nobody believed them. So I figured, okay, I've got to take some pictures so I can prove what I'm saying. Yes.
Exactly.
And so now I've got quite a few of those. But you're right, they're not on my walls. I have no pictures on the walls, for that matter.
Right.
Come home, the biggest thing you see is when you walk into the books.
Mm-hmm.
One of my walls is just books.
And cooking accessories.
You do have your artwork.
Yes.
Okay. And it's going to be, I'm just going to keep plugging this.
I appreciate that.
It's going to be at the Cotton Company in historic Wake Forest from February 7th through March 8th. Is there a website or a telephone number, Claudio?
I think they can go to the Cotton Company, www.cottoncompany.com or something like
that. Okay, to find out more.
Just look for the Cotton Company.
Anyway, Claudio, you'll be able to see Claudio in person.
Yes.
As well as his artwork.
You can throw things at me while I'm up there.
They don't have the chicken wire like they used to.
I might have it installed.
The old bars. Yeah.
Sounds like the Blues Brothers.
Exactly.
And if you are folks coming that listen to the radio show, I would certainly appreciate knowing. So let me know where you know this from.
Yes, say hi.
Give him a little tap on the shoulder. He'll clench his fists and we'll see what happens.
But he doesn't hit. He doesn't hit, really. He's a very peaceful character.
Yes, and... Unlike I was as a kid in South Africa, you were constantly attacked, and it was always by whites, by the Afrikaner rednecks that were there that didn't like the fact that you were a foreigner coming to their land.
Well, that's nothing new.
No. So I dealt with those prejudices very early on, and all my life I've never fought a black person. It's always just been, and I don't want to typify the rednecks, but we literally had to create our own little gangs just so we could get to school and back during any given day.
Hmm.
It's amazing the things your parents don't know that you go through just to get home and back.
Right.
Back
I'm sure that's true for kids today.
Oh, it certainly is, especially some of these street rivalries that go on.
Right.
You know, telling your parents makes you a sissy, so you don't.
That's right. Working with all the kids at the temple, I have kind of, you know, adopted them all, and I'm the cool aunt, and I know things that I don't want to know.
I'm sure.
But, you know, if I can be a little voice of reason, or at least just an ear, I think someone needs to listen to the kids and
they'll tell somebody
and
that
know
they
what
think,
they're going through, you know, even though I can't stop it or help it.
Yeah, but I think the reason that they may reveal themselves to you is because, you know, in the on the roadmap of our psyches, it does reveal something in the eyes or by what we look like, that we've been down that road ourselves.
Exactly.
And then children will come to you and reveal things that they'll never tell their parents.
Right. And they know that I will keep their confidence.
Right.
You know, unless there's
it's
real
a
danger
deadly situation,
exactly involved, which of course.
And then they're probably coming to you for that reason.
Right.
It's a cry for help.
That's
in
right.
some respects.
And there's no judgment from you.
Exactly.
Right. No.
Because I know I've done worse than they could ever.
I think we should turn the tables here.
Oh, don't worry. Peggy and I often do that. And this is entirely open for that. I actually, you were asking when I consolidated. The more I got into one artistic medium, the more I realized how it led to another and another and another. And I just decided to become not just to be fleeting from one to another, but to actually practice it as a craft. So I went put myself through a personal apprenticeship to study anything that I developed a passion for and became strong at it, became good at it. So I know a lot of times when people see the many different things I do artistically, they wonder if I'm not focused. It's all part of the same focus. Why put yourself in a cage? I mean, birds got to have wings to fly.
That's right.
So everything is interconnected from the visual to the written work to the performed work. And I see no disconnect at all.
To the eaten work?
Absolutely. The culinary arts, right?
That's right.
Yeah. And that was actually a design of my mother's, because her brother, my uncle and godfather, Oswald Meyer, is one of the great chefs of Europe, and he was the executive chef of the London Hilton for 25 years or more, just retired recently and moved to Palier, France. And he was also the one that prepared the wedding dinner for Prince Charles and Lady Diana.
Wow.
Matter of fact, he was the kind of godfather that always scolded me. Be a chef. You can become famous as a chef. You're good at what you do. Leave the arts as a hobby. And so years ago, when I got a standing ovation for performing Seafarers at Theatre in the Park, big write-up in the paper, big picture big enough to scare me, I sent him a copy. And without a single word, he sends me a menu from the royal wedding table.
Touché.
So there, exactly.
Exactly.
Now, if I only liked the royals, it might mean something.
True. So you studied cooking back in Germany?
Mm-hmm. Baden-Baden, Brunner's Park Hotel, yeah.
Uh-huh. That's where my people are from, Baden-Baden.
Really? Mm-hmm. My goodness.
I don't know any
of them. Must be quite well-to-do. Baden-Baden is one of these places that the wealthier classes live in.
No, I think they were probably the waiters.
On the outskirts, okay, yeah. Like me, okay.
Probably the cleaning people. Yeah.
It was an amazingly beautiful town, and I think one of the things that I don't know if this happened subconsciously, it just became an opportunity, and my uncle might have had something to do with it, knowing about the storyteller in me, but Baden-Baden is basically the Black Forest, which is where the Brothers Grimm come
right.
from.
Right. I've never been, but I will go.
So I was, because of knowing that, at 16, I during my apprenticeship, and we always had these split shifts, so you never really had a free day until you actually had a day off, and then it was a half a day, or one day you worked the first shift, and then you had that the night off, and the next day, and then you were back for the morning shift.
I know the feeling.
And I had accumulated, yes, I know you did. So, 20 years as a chef, there was no easy work. I had talked at least three or four other apprentices into making this trip into the Black Forest with me, because I just really needed to get away. I actually even managed to accumulate 3 days. And so I had several of them. And I said, let's do something extraordinary. Let's just take our sleeping bags and go into the woods and just really, let fly, hang out, get some meat, we'll cook it over an open pit and find a rock quarry that we can swim in the next morning, all these things.
Right.
And they were all so enthused and excited. I was able to stir people up pretty easily and got them excited. But then when the time came, every single one of them chickened out.
Aww.
And I was so focused on going that I went by myself. I hitchhiked about 50 miles away from the hotel and found a good place to enter the forest. And I just took my hiking bag with me, and I said, God, be with me, because it's just you and me. And I just walked way into these woods, and interestingly enough, found a little clearing that had a rock quarry and a big rock on the one far side of it. So I put my camping stuff on behind that rock so nobody could see me if they came to the opening. And I remember I cooked myself some of the meat I'd taken with me. I was just sitting there, and about 9, 10 o'clock in the it was still relatively daylight, around 9 o'clock, I'd say, a biker showed up. And he just, he seemed friendly enough, so I kind of let him know I was there. And he came by, hung out, and we talked for a while. He actually shared some of my food. And he told me he was really impressed that I was doing this, that I was just using it as a getaway. But anyway, I stayed out there for 2 days and nights, and just pretty much stayed by the rock quarry because I could swim in this beautiful water and then go and explore. And then on the way out of the woods, I got a little lost. So I still had a whole day to get back because my shift wasn't until the next morning. And I tried to find my way back to the road, but somehow got turned around, and I have no idea. I think this might have been God's design as well, because I remember just deciding to camp out next to this tree. It was getting too dark, and I didn't want to get more lost than I was. And I remember just rolling out my sleeping bag. I had a knife with me just in case I needed anything, and a slingshot. I've always had one of those from Africa. And I remember hearing these footsteps coming to me from the other side of the tree. It was a pretty wide pine tree. And then it stopped, and it stayed there. And I just told myself, well, it obviously doesn't know I'm here, and I can't make out, you know, it didn't feel like a bad vibe. So I just ignored it and slept sort of with one eye open, but I still dozed off. I was relaxed and I had my faith in the right places. And the next morning, early in the morning, still dew on the grass, and there was just this wonderful glow in the woods. This little fawn got up, shook itself free, and walked off, and it had laid next to me on the other side of that tree all night.
Wow, that's a great story.
What an inspiration. Yeah. And that was my weekend away in Baden-Baden in the
that's
Black Forest.
Beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And I walked home, and I have a picture that was taken of me that same day. It's on my website, where you can see my rucksack and me sitting on my bunk back in the personnel house. And every one of those friends that didn't go were envious.
I bet. So, what a great story.
Yeah.
If they had been there, the fawn wouldn't have come.
That's true.
That's right.
Yeah.
And you can hear more of Claudio's stories where?
The Cotton Company in historic Wake Forest from February 7th through March 8th. Coming up, he'll be staging recitals of his own writings along with his artwork. And the Cotton Company, how do you get there? You can go and
Hillsborough Main Street. It's right downtown.
Okay. And
I know you can get there from Capitol Boulevard, and there are all sorts of angles to approach it by, I'm sure.
And you can go to thecottoncompany.com or Google The Cotton Company, Wake Forest, North Carolina, and
That's
find
it.
Out more.
Hope to see you there.
And absolutely let Claudio know that you came from WCOM.
That's right. That way I can let the rest of the gang here know.
Yes. Claudio Speakeasy sent you there.
That it's working. So after Germany, you ended up doing most of your chefing in the Caribbean. Is that true?
Well, I came to the States, got bored with school very early on, left home when I was between 14 and 15, and my parents decided, okay, we've got to get this kid an education so he doesn't become a starving artist. And that's when the connection with my uncle and godfather came about. And in Germany, fortunately, they want you in apprenticeships from age 15 on, because that way they can make it part of your rhythm.
That's right, and you can learn a skill that you can actually use.
Right. And then I came back to the States, and I got a few gigs in some restaurants in Winston-Salem, and I realized, you know, I really don't have to be limited to this. There's a broader scope. And
I know you ended up in New York for a while.
Yeah, that was many moons later, helping run a bar on Broadway. On Broadway, 106 in Broadway. And I lived on 96 in Broadway. But going back to, where was I?
You were in Winston-Salem.
Winston-Salem. I wanted to leave Winston, first of all, so I moved from Winston to Raleigh, and I chefed at the Royal Villa Hotel years ago. It's now become, I think, a headquarters for a church, and back in the days when it was the Royal Villa, it was known as, it was known for good cuisine, I'd like to say that, because I did have high standards in gourmet cuisine, but it was also known as a bit of a whorehouse. And interesting to see that whorehouse has become a church.
Satisfying all kinds of tastes.
Yes.
That's right.
So there was that. And then where are we going from here?
We're going to the Caribbean.
Oh, right. And from Raleigh, I realized that there were some opportunities elsewhere. And one day I met this fellow as a waiter in a restaurant. And we were talking about him moving back to Florida. And he said, you know, in Florida, that there are places where you can work in some really fine restaurants and really build a name for yourself, or you can go out to sea. They hire chefs for yachts. And something about that just sort of stayed in my mind. He said, if you ever come, you can stay with me in Palm Beach. And so I sort of saved up some money, had about $300 in my pockets back in the 70s, got on my motorcycle and drove to Palm Beach. And this was right after reading Jack London's Seawolf. So I had an appetite.
So you were primed.
I wasn't even finished with the book, and I was on my wheels. And I was primed, yeah. And I rolled over to his place in Palm Beach, stayed with him for about a week, and he said, well, what are your plans? And I said, well, I've got about $200-some left. I'm going to get myself a place maybe go check out some restaurants and so on. And I still hadn't fully realized the possibility of going out to sea. I thought that seemed like more of a dream than the possible reality. He said, look, why don't you take your motorcycle and go down to Bahia Mar in Fort Lauderdale and just, you know, I said, how do I get these jobs? He goes, just go up to the dockmaster and see if he knows of anybody looking for a chef. Don't say cook, chef.
Mm-hmm.
And I walked up and sure enough got off the motorcycle and I said, not expecting, you know, this tree to bear any fruit so soon, but I walked up to the dockmaster and I said, you wouldn't happen to know of anyone here looking for a chef, would you? And he goes, as a matter of fact, there's a yacht, 69-foot yacht at the very end of the dock that just this morning put the word out that they're looking for a chef. Why don't you go down there and apply? And so I put my bike in a safe place and I walked down the dock and I knocked on the door or asked for permission to come aboard, and Captain took me on board. He considered my background. He said, well, listen, how about this? You come on board and fix cuisine for captain and crew for the next 3 days. If we like it, I'll hire you on. If we don't, then I'll pay you for your time and be on your way. Either way, you make out okay, and you can live on the boat.
That's right.
I said, perfect. So I called my buddy, said, I won't be coming home today. And I ended up staying on the yacht, and 3 days later, there's a knock on my cabin door. And the captain, cigarette in his mouth, blowing smoke into my room, which I couldn't stand. But I remember him looking at me, goes, well, Claudia, I sure hope you aren't planning to leave. And I said, does that mean I've got the gig? And he goes, Claudia, I've never tasted 16 flavors all at once. Yes, you've got the job.
Excellent.
So, and that led from one yacht to another. I became sort of the Coca-Cola of the yachting business. I could pretty much write my own ticket because I had a strong background. And most of what they were getting on yachts were glorified cooks. They weren't getting chefs. So it made it pretty easy. But I remember about a week into the run, we're crossing the ocean, my maiden voyage. And I said, by the way, who am I working for? I know you captain this vessel, but who owns it? And he goes, oh, you didn't know. I said, no. And he goes, well, Lorimar Productions. They were producing the Waltons at the time, Dallas later on, and then, you know, so on. And I loved the Waltons.
Sure.
I just happened to like those stories. And so we basically catered to them whenever they had guests or when the writer and actors and so on would come on board. So I actually walked right into a situation I liked very much.
So synchronicity has played a big part in your life.
Yeah, and just
being willing. That you haven't been at the right place at the right time, but that's kind of what that means.
I think so. Yeah, right. somehow, whenever I've taken these chances, because I've pretty much gone where the wind blew me, it's always been a good thing. I've never really regretted the experience.
Well, even when it's, you know, doesn't have quite a great outcome, you learn something.
You learn something,
that's
exactly. And that is the outcome.
Or that's what I tell myself anyway.
Right. That becomes the outcome,
that's
so
right.
to speak.
That's right. And then how did you end up in the Caribbean? Because that's where, you know...
Well, we took the yacht with Lorimar Productions, which is actually called the La Costa Brava, went first to the Dominican Republic, the other side of Haiti, the good side, and then from there to St. Thomas. And we picked up charter guests, and we'd run them around the Caribbean. And the first mate had actually lived in St. Thomas for a while, so he told me all about St. Thomas and what it was like to live there. And the entire time I was thinking, you know, living on an island wouldn't be a bad thing. And I just sort of put it in the back of my mind to do that, but I was cruising around the islands on all these different yachts anyway, just didn't have a whole lot of time ashore, except when you had 2 or 3 days off. And some years later, I was out there for about 8 years straight, just working on yachts and schooners. The last people I worked for was Rush, the Canadian rock and roll band, which was actually on a schooner built in 1937 for the King of Denmark, which was anchored out in Soper's Hole, Tortola, British Virgin Island. So you actually needed a passport to be there, which was really cool. But it was 11 miles across the channel from St. Thomas, so you could see the lights of St. Thomas from there. And I ended up doing radio shows. Somehow they always fell into my lap wherever I was. People just thought I should be on radio.
Well, with that voice.
And you should.
With that voice.
Exactly.
Come on.
Thank you. And it became a vehicle for announcing storytelling events happening in different places. But to answer your question about St. Thomas, some years later I was back in North Carolina just for a brief visit to the family here. And I got a request to help put on a function at the Pinehurst Hotel in Pinehurst, because they were honoring Arnold Palmer into the Hall of Fame, and Bob Hope and Bing Crosby were there as part of the celebration, and they wanted me to be sous chef to put the buffet together.
Wow.
And I thought, wow, yeah, sure. It was 3 days of good money, and but you know, no guarantee of... They were hiring me under the table. They just needed somebody really qualified for this massive event. And then I was gone. Well, at the end of it, I met one of the world's most famous ice sculptors, Olof Anderson, sorry. They called him Stu. He was from... I think it's I want to say Sweden, but it might
someplace
be wrong.
Someplace cold,
exactly. But he was the guy. This guy could knock out the most perfect swan in 5 minutes. He'd take a block of ice, go into the fridge and the freezer, and just boom, boom. You had that. I couldn't do that with my best
tries. Edward Scissorhands.
Yeah, exactly. I'm just extraordinary. It was nothing to him. And, you know, whatever you wanted, you just told him, and within 20 minutes, he had it. There it was, you know.
He learned how to do it fast so he could get out of the freezer.
Exactly.
That might have been the case. But at the end of the run, he pulled me aside and he said, "I wonder if you'd actually like to be my sous chef here." And he had a sous chef working with him at the time, but the guy was hitting the bottle a little hard.
Mm-hmm.
It was good, but you know you had to pick your times with him. And I looked at him and said, "Well, I'm really not planning to tie down here right now. I have no particular plans to go anywhere, but Pinehurst is a little removed from where I'm living my life these days, but thank you for the offer." And he said, "I really want you to think about that." He says, "You know, we'll get you a place here and we'll take care of you." And for some reason, it just didn't, something I wanted to do.
You weren't ready for Pinehurst
yet.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I was halfway out the door and he goes, "Okay, Claudia, hold on one." He said, "One more thing." He says, "Are you familiar with the Caribbean?" And I said, "Yes." He says, "Have you ever heard of Bluebeard's Castle?" And I said, "It's in St. Thomas, yes." He goes, "Well, they're looking for a sous chef. Would you be interested in that?" And I looked at him and said, "Yes, I would." And he goes, "What? I can't make you come 40 miles down the road, but you're willing to go to the Caribbean."
Sure.
I said, "Yeah." And it turns out he was the chef that originally opened Bluebeard's Castle. So anybody he recommended was in.
Mm-hmm.
And so they sent me a plane ticket and the whole works. And I ended up going. And that's how I went to Bluebeard's Castle in St. Thomas in the Virgin Islands. And that became me with my feet on the island and actually living among the natives. And I had an incredible time. I was the only white guy in a completely black operation.
Nice.
Running the kitchen, yeah. But it was a fantastic experience.
How long were you there?
At that particular time, with that position, I was there for a year, which is a respectable time in the restaurant business. But then I sort of bounced around to other neighboring islands, and St. Thomas to this day is a bit of a hometown for me. I guarantee you that if I got off the airplane in St. Thomas right now and just walked from the airport along Main Street to my usual hangouts, despite the fact that I've been gone since the 80s,
mm-hmm.
somebody would just go, "Hey, Claudia, how are you?" And, you know, I'd turn around. I actually recorded this years ago just to show you how there's no sense of time in the islands. And I'd been gone for 10 years, and somebody recognized me and just said, "Hey, man, where you been? Let's go have a drink." And I asked him, I said, "Do you remember the last time you saw me?" He goes, "Maybe a few years ago." I said, "No, it's been more like 10 or 11. And so there's no...
Yeah.
People don't forget you because they don't consider time.
That's right, which is the way it should be.
Yes, which is one of the things I love about the place.
Exactly.
But while I was if I may add this color to the whole thing, which is the reason I had my first taste of fame in St. Thomas, which I wasn't expecting. I was expecting to do what I loved, but I wasn't expecting to become a celebrity. I was performing with the pianist Nat Blake after hours at Bluebeard's Castle, and he had this wonderful thing where he could take songs like the old classics, Born Free, and mm-hmm. so on, and he would change the lyrics. Like, "Born free, my father's a doctor, my mother's a midwife, so why shouldn't I be born free?" And he would do stuff like that, and just have people in stitches. And he could even play the songs backwards.
Nice.
Which is just funny to listen to. But he would back me up on recitals. And one night I was reciting at Bluebeard's. The place was packed. And this big black guy gets up in the middle of the audience and goes, "Claudio, I want you on the radio." And I said, "Well, thank you very much. And who might you be?" And when I said that, the whole place just burst into laughter. It was like asking Elvis Presley who he was. And it turns out he was the big West Indian king of Calypso.
Uh-huh.
He had a radio show on Radio 1 called The King Obstinate Calypso Show, and he wanted me on as his co-host. So when
nice.
I became his co-host and I performed on the island as the African poet, the places just got packed because they liked me from the radio.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my first touch of... I couldn't walk into any bar or any establishment without somebody buying me a drink. I could have become a real alcoholic.
Yeah, that's not a bad way to live.
I kept passing drinks on to people I knew. I said, "Here, you need this.
You need this, yeah." So where did seafarers come into play?
During those travels, I just mm-hmm. felt like I had to write something about the sea. And interestingly enough, there's nothing in Seafarers that's about me. It's all, you know, what was inspired by the whole idea of the mythology of Mother Ocean. Certainly, I mean, the romantic expressions are mine.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't written on an ego plane.
It wasn't, "Today I woke up."
No, none of that. It was just, I'm telling you these interesting stories that sort of came to me while lying on the belly of this boat or being on, you know, some shack on the islands and so on. Just things that I basically souvenirs to myself. Mm-hmm. And none of them were, about me. And it took me years to write anything about being a chef. So I'm not very geared to speaking or writing about myself, which is part of the reason I guess we're doing this.
That's right. So we can see the man behind the voice. So then what's coming next other than the cotton?
The cotton company.
As far as I'm going to try and put Seafarers back on wheels next year with hopefully David Henderson and Ira David Wood doing some collaborating. And at some point I'd love to bring it to Temple when
I would too.
When that box opens.
Yes.
Has that opened yet, the black box?
Oh, no.
Not you still dealing with that, my goodness.
We need about $60,000.
Mm.
So if anyone listening would like the Black Box Theater in Sanford, North Carolina, named after them, naming rights are available.
Hey.
Or the restroom facility, we have naming rights available for that as well.
Interesting.
And you can just go to templeshow.com.
Temple Shows.
Shows. Templeshows.com to find out how you can donate that $60,000.
That's right.
But again, what I would like to mention is just because of the broad scope of artistic mediums that I'm involved in is that it's really all, and I think it's very difficult to get the average person to understand this, but it's really all part of the same focus. It's not that, you know, I like doing so many things and I have a short attention span or what do they call it, ADS or...
ADD DD or ADHD or...
Adult Attention
Dummy.
Deficit Disorder.
There you go.
Yeah. D-U-M-M-Y. it's all part of the same thing, and it was just, I think... The arts became, because of the scandal of my birth and just because of living in a family that was really only half my family and being sent off to boarding school because I was getting in too much trouble around the home and whatever it was, I think the arts just sort of became a refuge for me very early on. It was something I could sink myself into. And then I just got better and better and better at what I was doing, and then I decided to branch out and get better in other areas. But now when I look at it's just, if I'm ever alone at home, I've got a lovely selection to choose from of what I might want to do.
Right. And I think oftentimes creative people create for several reasons, but one of them is to create their own reality. And
yes.
You can do that.
Guilty
of that.
You can do
that visually. You can do that, you know, with the spoken word, and you can certainly do that, you know, with when you're creating your own masterpieces of
very
the culinary
arts. Which is what theater is as well.
That's right.
And sometimes that reality is a lot more interesting than boring people you might be subjected to at the time.
or you can write the boring people, you know, an untimely demise.
There we go, yes. My untimely demise has been much exaggerated. Yes.
It's true. So what are your plans for the holidays?
I'm actually spending these holidays by myself, I've chosen. Just
Well, you have a menagerie, so it's not like you're by yourself.
Yeah, right. I'm spending some time at the Carolina Theater taking duties that the more traditional people would rather not do because of the timing.
Mm-hmm.
And then just going to enjoy my holiday, possibly communicating or chatting on the phone or sending an email to some friends, but ultimately just staying home, maybe listening to good music and kicking back. I'm really not a traditionalist. I see this. I'm probably the more of the bar humbug when it comes to Christmas. To me, it's such a big commercial enterprise that it can go away as far as I'm concerned.
Right.
Well, what kind of prep work are you doing? Any special things for the show that's coming up?
For the art show,
yeah.
I'm creating some new pieces. Although I've already got more than 100, so. It's sort of fun to, I think it's funny when different aspects of your artistic psyche become recognized, how that sort of activates energy levels and you sort of go to that place, because I must have drawn 50 sketches in the last few days while doing other things, just sort of sat there. And I've developed this new technique, and new perhaps in the sense of not something people might normally do, but I'll take a canvas or art paper and I won't even conceive of a design. I might decide that I want to do, for example, the theater masks, you know, the tragedy and drama, mm-hmm. or whatever, and then just put my pen or marker to the paper and just draw away with my eyes closed, imagining that I see exactly where things need to be placed, which, by the way, is how yours was.
That's
done.
Great. Mine's really cool.
And creating this abstract without actually ever seeing the paper. But the work is not done until I take the pen away from the paper. So what you've got there was done from start to finish without me ever leaving the page.
That's really neat.
You too.
This is great. And I just want to let people know, this is The Cotton Company, www.thecottoncompany.net.
located at 306 South White Street in Wake Forest. And if you want to call them up, you can go 1-800-937-3993, because Claudio is going to be there from February 7th through March 8th, staging his own recitals, showing along this an artwork that he's already got 100 pieces and is creating
large
more
and
stuff.
Small.
Mm-hmm. And the Cotton Company is a place where artists can work and sell their work as well.
Now, you're not going to be living there, are you?
So, no.
So there are certain hours where you'll be appearing.
There'll be certain performance dates.
Like the artist is in residence, really in residence.
Yeah,
stuck there for a month and see what happens.
They keep their artists in residence there for certain periods of time, and I think they've got 3 or 4 of them, or maybe even 6 booths for that, where people work on site. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm just going to be, my art is going to be hanging, and I guess selling, or however they do that, for that entire time. But I'm only going to be booked to make personal appearances, you know, certain times throughout that.
Right, so people should go to the website or call to make sure that they get to come and see you.
Yeah.
TheCottonCompany.net. 1-800-937-3993.
And, of course, this is Claudio Speakeasy, the literary and all else, with my co-host Audrey Layden and my interviewer, Peggy Taphorn, with Temple
Theatre.
I was nice.
Wasn't I nice to you?
Yes, you were.
I didn't dig out any huge
toast him, really.
Skeletons.
Pummeling.
No, exactly.
Something tells me this is only the start, so we'll see what the future brings.
Exactly. But we have a couple of minutes left, so what are people most surprised by when they meet you and hear these stories? And what do you think? What do you think is your most guarded aspect of your personality?
Most guarded aspect. I was going to say, in response to your question about what are people most taken by when my stories come from, it's sometimes they'll hear one of them and go, God, where the hell did that come from? It was fascinating, though. Most guarded element? Probably my privacy. I think that's probably one of the reasons I've averted success in certain areas, because I realized the privacy that you would have to give up. I like my place in the woods. I like being removed. I like socializing with people I want to socialize with. Mm-hmm. I'm not a good butt kisser, so that takes me out of that realm. I would say just my privacy and maintaining close relationships with friends. To me, my friends are my family.
Mm-hmm.
Very much in that order.
Well, and I think that the life that you've chosen allows you to keep with your creative flow.
Absolutely.
Like you said, with success comes a lot of trappings.
Yes.
And I've seen a lot of people in my time in New York and beyond just get sucked into that black hole. And then you lose not only your muse, but you lose your friends. You lose the sense of yourself. You lose reason why this all started. Because then it comes all about being famous, as opposed to being true to your art, or being true to yourself, or being true to your friends. It's all about, I only do this and I hire this publicist and I get this marketing person, then I'll go to the next step. And you know, by the time you're on the cover of Us Weekly, does it really matter?
And all of a sudden, you're really doing things that are not part of the artistic rhythm at all. And it's not always you that becomes strange to your friends, because I know that my own psyche is strong enough to remain who I am now and mm-hmm. still love the people I love and not really change. But a lot of times, friends change their attitudes when you suddenly become more recognized. I've run into that on lesser scales, where they suddenly develop this little God image of you, which is not welcome in my book, and cop attitudes or decide that I should be a certain way because I'm now more known and so on and so forth. I think it's probably getting time to wrap the speakeasy.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to let you exit us out there, Peggy.
Well, thank you all very much for listening. And this was very interesting for us to get a little background on Claudio. And thank you for having me on. Come and visit the Temple Theater. Again, the box office is 774-4155 or templeshows.com. It's always a pleasure. Wonderful to meet you. And happy holidays, however you choose to spend them.
Happy holidays indeed. Cheers.
Till next week.